John Kleinig speak. I'm Professor Jeff Pulse. I'm in charge of continuing education here at the seminary. A few other things and teaching the Old Testament department. So I'm pretty excited about this opportunity to get a continuing ed course here on campus to begin with. And this will be my first experience in doing that. We hope to continue to offer those things on campus perhaps next year. I'm at this point trying to winsomely convince Dr. Adam Francisco to join us next year. And so I'm taking him deer hunting, and we'll see how that works out. But I'll keep you posted. It's amazing how people say yes when you have a gun. That's all I'm saying. But today, we have the opportunity to have Dr. John Kleinig here. And judging by the amount of people sitting in the room, we guessed correctly that that would be a very good way to start our continuing ed courses here at the on campus. Dr. Kleinig has 26 years of teaching, I believe it is, at the Lutheran Seminary in Adelaide. And now that he is retired, the busiest retired guy I've ever met, but now that he's retired, he's been guest teaching and doing such things at various seminaries and various conferences all around the world, actually. So we're very excited to have him here and excited that you're able to join us with that. Just a couple, before I bring him up here for this very interesting topic, just to let you know, we are live streaming this to a classroom so that the students can come and go whenever they're out of class and take advantage of some of this as well, because we really felt that it's wrong to have such a wealth of wisdom on campus and not let the students also have some opportunities to engage him. There will be, he'll also be talking to them on Tuesday night at a fireside chat. And on Wednesday at 7, there will be a fellowship time at my home, which isn't too far away, and I'll give you some directions, where we'll join around adult beverages and other snacks and have a chance to visit and enjoy life and all those, good and gracious gifts and things like that. So that'll be Wednesday, have that chance. So we're going to try to let you have access to Dr. Kleinig on several levels. I think that also will be something you will enjoy. So without too much more talking, first of all, Kara, you met her coming in. If there are issues, please talk to her. She knows how to solve them. I only know how to listen, but she can solve them. And that's the one you want to talk to. She can help you sort things through. And so if you have anything that we can help you with in your stay here, we will do our best. Now, I would like to have our presenter come forward. He's going to, from slavery to divine service, God's foundation of Israel as a liturgical community in Exodus. Kleinig?
With that dramatic introduction, I should come bounding in. It gives me great pleasure to be here and to be with you all and people from all over the place here in the USA and even some international people. And it gives me a great pleasure too to be talking to you on this topic. But before I get to that, just some preliminaries. First of all, I bring you greetings from the President of the Lutheran Church of Australia, Dr. Mark Semler, and the principal of Australian Lutheran College. That's what it's called now. It used to be Luther Seminary. It's a change name. John Henderson. A couple of other preliminaries before I get started. First of all, do you all have the course notes? I've given you a summary of what we may be covering, what I intend to cover. It's available in print form, but now, Cara, did you also circulate these in electronic form, the course notes? Yes, so if you have received them, you can, I see some of you got your computers here. If you want to take notes, you can sort of insert it in your in the course notes. But if not, we can make sure that the material is available to you electronically. As far as the order goes, now we'll be meeting for an hour now, and once I get wound up, I tend to lose track of time. Could you let me know when, what's at 9 o'clock?
Yep. But we will be taking go to chapel at 10.
Yes.
But if you want a short break somewhere after an hour.
Now, what was the schedule?
2 hours.
2 hours, okay. We'll just have a little bit of a break at 9 o'clock there. Okay. Just for you, to make it easier for you. I better have the schedule here. Now, also, as I'm going, if there are any questions or comments or further discussion, if you'd like to throw in any of your own insights, please don't wait till the end of a session when I say, are there any other questions? Bring them up at the point. Now, the reason why this is important is that if you wait, then it's no, you lose the context of your question or comment or your insight. I'm a bit sad that the class is so large because this limits the interaction between us. I would have liked to have had much more interaction, so I apologise for the fact that I'm going to be doing most of the talking. That's bad for you. And it's also bad for me because I'm still getting over jet lag. And if at some time I get spaced out, or if the worst comes to the worst, and I actually put myself to sleep, my excuse is that I'm still getting over jet lag. Now, the topic, as you have heard, is From Slavery to Divine Service, God's Foundation of Israel as a Liturgical Community in Exodus. Some preliminary points that I'd like to make. First of all, what's my overall purpose in teaching this course? Well, it's quite simple. It's to try to recapture for you and the church, Missouri Synod, but Lutheran Church, and more generally, the church, a fundamental understanding of the church as a liturgical community. What is it that makes the church different to any other organization or community? Well, if you look at it sociologically, it's quite simple. It's a liturgical community. Now, by liturgical, sometimes, at least in Australia, people get freaked out and they think of liturgy in the narrow sense as an order of service. But if in English we had a more adequate word, I would be pleased to use it. If we had an adjective for the divine service. So it's a divine service community. It's a ritual community, it's a religious community, or put it another way, what constitutes Israel and the Church of Jesus Christ is the fact that it is a worshipping community, a community that's constituted by worship. Now, of all churches, we Lutherans should have been the last to lose that very important insight. You may remember the Augsburg Confession basically defines everything liturgically. It gives, Dr. Zusser used to say, the first dogmatic definition of the church. Remember the article on the church? The church is what? The assembly of the saints in which the gospel is purely taught and the sacraments are rightly administered. The church is an assembly, number one. Ecclesia means assembly, sometimes translated congregation, but if you go that way, people here, at least in North America, go in the wrong direction. It's a liturgical assembly, and it's assembly of the saints, the holy ones. We'll be coming to that and exploring that. It's an assembly of holy people. And what lies behind that, the holy ones, indicates that it's not just an assembly of congregational members, but it is all the hagioi, the holy ones. Now, who are all the holy ones? Well, it is the communion of saints. All Christians around the world, all Christians who have ever lived, and all Christians who will ever live, and even more wonderfully than that, the holy ones, Old Testament, New Testament, are the angels. So it's an assembly of holy human beings together with holy angels. So it is an assembly. And that assembly is defined in liturgical terms, in which the gospel is rightly taught, and the sacraments are, some translations have correctly administered, but rightly administered. Right by rightly, it's you find elsewhere in the Ultimate Confession, means that they are administered according to their divine institution. Another word that I'm going to look at shortly, that's very important in our understanding. So if you're going to understand the church, the only way of making good sense of it is to understand it liturgically. The core of the church is worship. And the church is a worshiping community. And that means that you need to define the ministry in liturgical terms. What's the ministry? It's the ministry of word and sacrament. What's most of your pastors? What's your core task? Is to lead in worship. Look, it's so obvious. It's not rocket science. It's to lead in worship. And what's the core business of leading in worship? It means preaching, teaching, but also enacting the word, law, and gospel. It's the community in which the gospel is purely taught. That purely indicates that it rightly distinguishes law and gospel. It rightly enacts law and gospel. Can I just have a little aside here about teaching? I don't know whether you realize that the sense of teaching has changed its meaning in the last 300 or 400 years. And you can see that, and I could demonstrate that from the words that are used in the Old Testament. It used to be that teaching was teaching you not what to think, but teaching you what to do, and then also how to think. So it's practical teaching, not theoretical teaching. Please always remember that doctrine is practical teaching. It's teaching. So the doctrine of prayer has to do with teaching people how to pray. The doctrine of worship is teaching people what worship is and how you do it. It's not, the focus isn't on thinking, but on doing. So the Augsburg Confession defines ministry, the office of ministry, the office of the keys in liturgical terms. It speaks about justification in liturgical terms. How does justification occur? Remember that? In order to obtain this faith, the ministry of preaching the word and administering the sacraments has been instituted, through which, as through means, the Holy Spirit is given when and where he wills to those who hear the gospel. So how does justification occur? As far as the way we receive it, it's liturgically. We go to church in order to be justified. Notice too, we go to church, and this is very important for the modern context, we go to church in order to receive the Holy Spirit. You want to be filled with the Spirit? Go to church. Not just once, but every Sunday. So, my purpose in teaching the church, teaching Exodus, beginning there, is to see how Israel was primarily a liturgical community, and to see how the church is primarily a liturgical community. Now, I would put to you that, the scriptures are primarily a liturgical text. We call this the Holy Bible. Why is it called the Holy Bible? Well, it not only contains the Holy Word of God, but holiness has to do always with worship. It comes out of worship, and it was brought together for the purpose of worship. Why was it that the Jewish rabbis, you know, as far back as we go, why was it that the Old Testament texts were brought together into the Old Testament? The answer is, for liturgical purposes. For liturgical purposes, for liturgical use. To show people how to do worship. And to teach people about worship. Likewise, the New Testament. Now, I'm giving you a very little bit of introduction here, but something that it was axiomatic that we forgot. We talk about the canon of the scriptures, canon of New Testament books. Why was it that the early church brought together those books that now constitute the New Testament? What was their practical reason? They were not theoreticians. They were interested in practicalities. They brought those books together for what purpose?
For use in the church.
For use in the church. And not just for preaching and teaching, but for everything in the church. For praying, for praising, for confessing sins, for administering the sacraments, blessing, everything. It was, the scriptures were brought together for liturgical use. And how do you know the right way of worship? You go to the scriptures. They were brought together for liturgical use. Now, this is not new, but it needs to be emphasized. Now, if there is one book in the Old Testament, which is obviously liturgical, or a set of books that are obviously liturgical, it is the book of Exodus together with the book of Leviticus. Leviticus is a liturgical text. It's interesting that modern theology only looks at the first half of Exodus, up to Sinai. But if you read the Pentateuch as a whole, you get a different picture, realize that this is merely introductory. Because if you take the Pentateuch story, Genesis basically focuses on the ancestors, the fathers of Israel, and it ends up with Israel in Egypt. I won't go into that, but that's preliminary. Then you get to Exodus. Exodus 1 to 20 is the journey from Egypt to Mount Sinai. So Exodus 1 to 20. And then we come Exodus 21. Through all of 21 to 40, the whole of Leviticus, and then Numbers
1 through to 10, if my memory serves me right. All that material is is given in one location. Do you know what the location is?
Tabernacle.
This is Egypt.
Sinai.
Yeah. This is Sinai material. And then the rest of Numbers is the journey from Sinai to Kadesh, and then from Kadesh to the Promised Land. And then you come to the book of, I better look at the, yeah, you come to Deuteronomy, it's the farewell sermon of Moses before entry into the Promised Land, the covenant on the plains of Moab. Oh, that's bad. notice here that the center of the Pentateuch is where? This material here.
The tabernacle.
Yeah, the tabernacle, the divine service, the priesthood. Just putting it quite simply, it has to do with God's gift of the divine service to his people. The focus here at Sinai is the divine service, of which the tabernacle is part. Okay, now I'm going to do an in-service, a continuing education up at Grand Rapids on Leviticus, done a commentary on Leviticus, which is perhaps the most neglected book in the whole of the modern Christian tradition. I think there's only one reading from Leviticus in the three-year lectionary. Yet, if you have a look at the early Christian tradition, the patristic tradition, and particularly the Jewish tradition, it in fact is, there's more commentaries, there's more sermons on Leviticus than in any other part of the Old Testament except the Psalms. What is least important for us, what's most important, is still to the present day, most important for our Jewish brothers and sisters, and was most important for the early church. Now that shows that we have a problem here in our modern theology, and has to do with worship and the fact that we find it difficult to do full justice to the divine service. Hence we have worship wars that all of you have been engaged in and will continue to be engaged in as long as you live. That's the good news. Yes, I don't need to hold this all the time. So my focus, if you like, is going to be liturgical. On two things. God's establishment of the divine service, the gift of the divine service to Israel at Sinai. All this material here, notice it's all of Leviticus, half of Exodus, and first 10 chapters of Numbers is liturgical material. It has to do with the gift, God's gift of the divine service to his people at Sinai. Now, and what's significant is that it is at Sinai. It's not in Egypt. It's not in the Promised Land. It's at Sinai. So the gift of the divine service, and then secondly, the identity of Israel as a unique community. Now, if you ask the Israelites, and you can see it actually in the scriptures, if you ask the Israelite, what makes you different to all other nations on the earth? You could say they were descendants of Abraham, but why is that not an adequate answer?
There are
other descendants of Abraham, and we have them very much in the Middle East to the present day. The whole Arabs and then the Muslim tradition, all the Semites are descendants of Abraham. Abraham, even they're not all descendants of Jacob. But the simple answer that would be given, what makes them different to all other nations, is that they are a holy people, a holy priestly people. That's what makes them different. And why are they holy? Because God is with them. And how is he with them? Through the tabernacle, in the divine service, they alone, of all the nations of the earth, have access to God's heavenly presence here on earth. And that makes the difference. They are a holy people. And so, at the core of their understanding of themselves, they see themselves as a nation, as a liturgical community, if I can put it in modern terms. Righto, can I just pause there? Any questions? Have I been making sense? Now, this Australian who comes here and speaks in a funny accent. By the way, if I use expressions that you don't understand, please flap your hand and I'll try to translate in good American English. Any questions or any comments? Yes, please.
Could you just flesh out the word teach again in terms of the fact that originally the meaning was to do more than the reflective, to think?
Yeah, there's a question of reflection involved in it, but the way of teaching and learning until modern times was basically, comes out of the family, comes out of trades, and is basically the model is the apprenticeship model. And even in schools, basically, were built up on apprenticeship kind of thing. You were taught to do things, and you were taught by doing. And in the religious tradition, this, as you can see, it's still to the present day very clearly in the Mohammedan tradition, in the Jewish tradition, religious instruction is not teaching you what to think, an ideology or philosophy, but teaching you what to do. Teaching you to worship, teaching you to pray, teaching you to live a Christian life, a godly life. Right? So it's teaching to do. Okay, there's a lot of reflection involved, there's thinking involved, but the focus is not on theory, but on, and this is a modern, this is since the Enlightenment, theory, practice. This is a lot of the problems that we have in our society is that terrible distinction between theory and practice. But don't get me going on that. I'll never get away from that. Teaching is teaching to do. Right? Is that clear?
Is there anything in the actual derivation of the word to teach?
Not in English itself is not clear. But say, for example, if you go to Hebrew, and since I'm talking the Old Testament, I'm allowed to use Hebrew. The basic Hebrew word, verb for teaching is horah, from which you get Torah. Now, the Jewish term, one of the Jewish terms for the first five books of the Old Testament is that it is the Torah, which we usually translate as the law. Now, law for us has a different sense to law for Aboriginals or law for traditional people. Torah is basically teaching. And it's a particular kind of teaching. It's practical teaching. So horah, which is the verb, is to teach people practically and teach them to do something. So you get it there. It comes from trades, apprenticeship kind of stuff. It comes from home, family. It's what a mother does to her daughters by teaching them how to cook and all that kind of thing. what she does is engages in Torah teaching, but practical teaching. Or what a farmer does to his sons is teach him how to farm. There's lots of skills involved in farming.
Deuteronomy 6.
Look, it's everywhere. Yes. The Torah. And you can see it's used in that educational sense very clearly in the book of Proverbs. Now, you won't get this in English translations, unfortunately. So, yes, it's there. And there's other verbs then for teaching. There's more where you get teacher-disciple, which is basically master-apprentice kind of thing. There's another verb for that. But in the Old Testament, this is the important verb for us. So take something very simple. You go through, you can read through particularly Leviticus and say, this is the Torah of the burnt offering. We'll come across one, I think, one of these passages. The Torah of the burnt offering. Now, usually it's translated the law of the burnt offering. But if you probe a bit deeper, what does it mean? The law of the burnt, and that's not wrong, the law of the burnt offering, what's its purpose?
Instruction.
It's an instruction on how to do the burnt offering. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right, so the law of the burnt offering is the instruction on practically how do you do the burnt offering. So that's Torah. It always has that very concrete, practical sense. You with me?
Yep.
It's not very difficult, and it's so obvious once you see it. But it's quite a long distance from our modern educational system and our modern educational theory. Although some of the best modern educational theory is coming back to this sense. Any other questions before I go on? Yes?
Nothing happens in a vacuum.
Yes.
And so behind all of this, we have Satan and his minions.
Yes.
And so, in a sense, what God is doing here, from my perspective, is
yes.
kind of sticking it to Satan.
Yes.
From the perspective of, you know, you've got your worship and,
yep.
and all of that.
Yep.
And so God now is forming all the, well, in another sense, a military expedition,
yep.
Or spiritually, against Satan.
And we'll be coming to this. That's some very, very important insight. That I'll be elaborating as we go on the next couple of days. It's not as explicit as that in the Old Testament because the front of Satan is not directly. There's only a couple of places where Satan's mentioned in the Old Testament explicitly. Now, the front is not between God and Satan, but God and the pagan gods. It's... The God and the gods of Egypt, Moses and Pharaoh. So as we go, as I'm able, I'll always, again and again, come back to the contrast between pagan ways of thinking and acting, pagan ritual,
how many of you are pagan?
Which has been taking the devil, the evil one, taking what's right ritual, what's good ritual, and using it for evil purposes to do his dirty work. And so the whole of God's activity is to retrieve not just Israel, but the whole of humanity from wrong worship to right worship, from service of Satan to service of God. In terms of Exodus, from the service of Pharaoh and the Egyptian gods to the service of the Lord. Yes, so there's always that front. And teaching then is in that context. Unteaching to reteach. Okay, Now, I want to talk a little bit on a different topic, and that's the whole notion of founding stories. I would put to you that Exodus is a foundational document for Israel. If Israel is a holy community, a liturgical community, then the book of Exodus tells the story of how they came to be a liturgical holy community. It's a foundational document. Now, I want to look a little bit at this because I think it's very, very helpful, and it's helpful for, very important for you to, as pastors and people in the church, to understand what you are on about and the importance of the story of your congregation, the story of the founding of your congregation, the importance of building on the right foundations. And for you not to come in as a revolutionary trying to build something in the air, but to build on real solid foundations. If I can just use the analogy, I mean a building analogy, unless you build a building on sound foundations, what's going to happen to the building? It won't last. It might last for your lifetime, but it's not going to last two or three lifetimes. Unless you place a community, in this case a congregation, on the right foundations, it won't last. And it's important that you know what the right foundations are. If you're starting a congregation, to place it on the right foundations, and to then for people who come after you to build on those foundations, maybe correcting parts that are not on those foundations, endanger the building, but to build up on the right foundations. Now, behind this lies a notion which is very, very alien to modern thinking ever since the Enlightenment. Okay? We have had great difficulty with the past and history and the importance of the past. Now, it's hard to pin down except in abstract terms, but basically, if I can put it, we imagine ourselves placed in time and space. Now, particularly in English, the English language, basically, the verb has three tenses. What are the three tenses? Past, present, and future. Where are we? In the present. Where is the past? Behind us. Where is the future? It's in front of us, ahead of us. Now, what does that mean about the past?
Over.
It's over, and if it's over, it's what?
Done.
It's done, and dealt, and dealt and dusted. It's irrelevant. And we have the illusion that we are looking where? Forward. Into what?
Better places.
A better place. A better future, a better society. You have that in your constitution. can you in fact see the future? No. Your whole society, America, is a future-oriented society. Just look at Obama, his whole rhetoric, the audacity of hope. Going forward. The whole notion of progress has the idea that we have the past behind us, and the past is, you know, evaluating is always less than good. Where is the good society always? In the future. And things are going to get better. They're bad in the past, they're good in the future. Now, that's the conceit of modernism, is this. Now, in fact, it is totally unreal, because what's the only thing we can see? is the present and the past. Now, if I can reverse the picture, the old way of thinking, the common sense way of thinking, is that we aren't walking forward into the future, but we're walking back into the future. What can we see? We can see where we are, but we can only see where we are, not because of where we're going, but where we have come from. So what lies in front of us is the past. And we only know where we are if we see ourselves in the light of the past. The past is there, present before us. Now, if Eugene Peterson says, if you're going to be a good pastor, you've got to be a good historian. You need to know the past of your congregation. You need to know the past, the story of each member of your congregation. You need to know your own story. You need to work with the stories of people. Okay? The past is far more important. Even when people deny it, I say somebody like Obama, who has this rhetoric of the audacity of hope and going to the future, you can't really make sense of that guy unless you see that he's obsessed by what? What part of the past? More exactly than colonialism. What's his race? He's black. And what's the basic story of any black person in America?
Slavery.
It's slavery. I mean, that's the story. You can't make sense of it, and you can't make sense of Americans electing him unless you see that it's part of that whole terrible story of slavery, emancipation, civil war, all that kind of stuff. Now, I'm a foreigner. I don't see it the way you see it. I'm not living in it. I'm living outside of it. So the past is important. And even though you are a future-oriented society, what's most important for you is certain founding stories and certain founding documents. If I asked you, what are the foundational stories and documents for the USA? Now, I don't know whether I've got it right, but I've heard people say it, and I've read enough American stuff to know that you have a very funny foundational story. What's the basic foundational story of the USA? The Pilgrims, the Pilgrim Fathers. Every Thanksgiving reminds you of that. The Pilgrim Fathers who came over to where? Massachusetts. And they were religious refugees coming from Europe, and Europe was a bad place. That they escaped from. They came here to establish New Jerusalem, the city set on the hill, all that kind of stuff. Now, are they, in fact, historically speaking, the founding, I've got to be careful, the founding people of the USA? Historically speaking, no. Why?
The Native Americans.
The Native Americans here were, and they're offended by that story. That's not their story. They have their own story of here. The conceit is that these Pilgrim Fathers were the first people to come to the USA. Or there were French people, I think, here before the Pilgrim Fathers. I don't know my history quite so well.
There were some Vikings.
Vikings came. And raped and pillaged as much as they could. Good Viking fashion. However, what's significant, if you like, the founding myth, the founding legend of modern USA is that it began when? With the Pilgrim Fathers. Now, as far as I know, the other very important founding events were, what's next? I mean, you get other colonies coming, but then the next big thing is the Declaration of Independence. Important, a foundational event. Do you actually commemorate that any time of the year?
July 4th.
July the 4th, that's what I thought so. So you have Thanksgiving Day. And look at the national commemorations. They tell your foundational stories. So July the 4th. Then after the Declaration of Independence, which is the next great event, that's not commemorated but has seared your national consciousness.
Yeah, the Constitution.
Hmm?
The Constitution.
Now that's a document, I'll come back to that.
The Civil War.
You can't understand the USA and that they are the United States of America apart from that terrible event. And Obama, if you like, is the and everything. Your political parties all come have their roots in their modern configurations out of the Civil War. Fascinating case, and it's a unique story, and it's a terrible story. Okay, we could go further. You know, they're the foundational events. Now, Australia, we Australians have a less glorious history.
Penal colony.
Yeah, we were, yeah.
Penal colony.
We were a penal colony. Captain Phillip came to Port Arthur, to Sydney Cove, and established a penal colony. And we celebrate that, and it's becoming, whereas it's a matter of sort of shame, it's now in a funny modern inversion, it's a matter of pride, whereas people used to be ashamed of having convict ancestry. Now they flaunt it. Now it's a matter of pride. Which tells you a lot about Australians. And, you know, our funny, ironic, twisted way of thinking. That's in terms of foundational event, that's number one. But in fact, that wasn't the foundation of Australia because we had Aboriginal people living there for thousands of years. And they have their own foundational stories. Their mythology. Now, in Australia, then the next big event is Federation. Now, there were a number of colonies, but there was Federation then in 1901, where all the colonies came together in one country. And then we have a third foundational story, which is something like your Civil War, and that is Anzac Day. Now, you won't understand us unless you realise the significance of Anzac Day. Now, what's Anzac Day all about? First World War. We had Australian young men volunteered to come to the defence of king and country against those terrible Huns. And where were they sent? By Churchill to the Dardanelles. Now, where Turkey, you know, you have the Bosphorus, going through, and you have that narrow straits. Turkey was in alliance with Germany, and it was Churchill's idea to take the Dardanelles to establish a second front from the east. Now, if ever there was a military botch-up, it's the landing at Gallipoli. That's the name of the place. Now, that Gallipoli, for any Australian, is his holy name. The landing at Gallipoli, which was an utter botch-up under the leadership of, you know, the British generals. They landed in the wrong place, over high hills, on a narrow beach, where the Turks had the guns, and they were just basically cannon fodder. It's a remarkable story, because there's two things. It's not that they won the victory, that's quite often a foundational story in nations where you have a spectacular victory, establishes, gives the identity of a country. This battle was neither won nor lost. They, Australians, endured and survived. Now that's inherent in our mentality. For you, the archetypal American is the winner. For us, it is the what we call the battler, the survivor. They survived, and not only did they survive, but the most remarkable part of that story is that they managed to withdraw the complete army from that. They were had only managed to penetrate a number of miles inland under the eyes of the Turks over three consecutive nights without the Turks realizing what was happening. So when they finally had come out of the trenches on the last night, the Turks came and found that there was nobody there. And it was this amazing story of ingenuity of how they managed to fool the Turks to be, you know, always an army when it withdraws is most vulnerable. Now, okay, I'm not teaching you Australian history, and I'm not even teaching you American history, but I want you to get a sense then from this of the importance of Exodus and the importance of founding stories and founding documents. Now, for you, you have your founding stories, but then you have your foundational documents. One of the foundational documents that every American student learns in school, there is the... Sorry? Declaration of Independence. The Constitution. Constitution. Now, that's far more important for you than almost any other country in the world. The Constitution with the Bill of Rights and its amendments. So your Declaration of Independence, Constitution, Bill of Rights, amendments. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. And then there is another very interesting foundational document.
Emancipation Proclamation.
The Proclamation of Emancipation. And then in connection with the Civil War, what's the... Gettysburg Address. Now, the actual circumstances of that are remarkable because there's another guy who gave the great big oration, who got all the adulation, and Lincoln scribbled this on the back of envelope or something. It's very, very short, as you know. And yet, it somehow, if you want to summarize what America's on about, its story, it's the Gettysburg Address. Am I right? Okay. Now, so foundational stories, foundational documents, what is their function? They give you identity. That's number one. They tell you who you are. And in a society like America, Australia, that's important because ethnicity and language, all that doesn't give you identity. What's the problem? You get migrants from all over the world. What is it that holds you together? What is it that unifies you? So it's not just identity, but also unity and the purpose of the nation. What are you here for? Who are you? What do you have in common with other people? What's your task? What's your mission? What's your purpose as a community, as a nation? Very, very important. Far more important, in fact, than the political system are these foundational legends, stories, these foundational documents. And always, if you're going to go forward into the future, what you do? You build on the past. You build on this. So, in fact, the American Constitution becomes more important now than it ever was. In fact, it was a kind of a jerry-built kind of thing to try and get the show off the road initially. But now it's become sacrosanct, hasn't it, for politicians, and particularly for this justice system, yes.
Is it possible that over the course of time, demographics can so weaken that agreement on foundational documents that a country is in danger of falling apart?
Yes.
And that would be part of the Soviet Union's problem?
That's the Soviet Union's problem, and because it would... Yeah, and that's a typical case in point, where all that you had, it was an imperial society, where all you had holding people together was power and force and punishment. And you can only hold a group of people... No. Through oppression, various forms of oppression, that's the exercise of power, so long before it crumbles. Because what oppression does is divides people. See, it's nations are remarkable institutions, precarious institutions. Congregations are unnatural institutions. I don't know if you've ever thought that take your congregation, you don't get the same sort of spread of people together. People not who have the same interests, who are similar, but unlike people anywhere else in the USA. It brings together unlike people. And if you lose your foundational stories, if you lose your foundational documents, if they are weakened, and then there's also, and we touched on this with in connection with Thanksgiving and 4th of July, you have certain key rituals. Rituals are what establish and build up communities. So if you want to undermine a community, what do? You destroy their rituals, or you subvert their rituals. You subvert ritual, you mock the foundational, discredit the foundational stories, you discredit the foundational documents. There's something that's very important. So take, for example, Missouri Synod. What is its foundational story?
CFW.
You know better than I do.
CFW Walther, Martin Stephan.
Yes, and it's a very odd foundational story because it's very Australian because, you'd expect a glory story, but in fact it is a little bit shameful. Because lying behind it is that story of Stefan, a great man but with great weakness. And then you have who's stepping in the breach? Walther. And now he, in fact, was not as important at the time, the whole group of people, but as time's gone on, he's become more and more important. So that's the foundational story that's told over and over again, and that constitutes your identity. Now, we could go further and say, what are your foundational documents? What's your foundational ritual? Now, if you wanted to destroy the Missouri Synod, sociologically speaking, how would you do it? And it's been done. It's being done at the moment, as far as I can see. You get rid of the things that unite you. Now, what's one of the most important foundational documents for you as a synod? And for all, what?
Long gospel?
No, that's an idea.
A theological.
A document. Document.
A hymnal.
The Constitution.
But more important than the Constitution, you didn't start, that comes late in the piece.
The Common Scriptures, page 15.
That's very important.
Lutheran Confessions.
Okay, that's foundational. It was all about confessions. They are foundational. Oh, they're older than you, because they're also our foundational document is the Lutheran Confessions. Then you get Lutheran Confessions, then you get the Divine Service, and that's been a little bit ambiguous in our history. And in more recent times, your Constitution has been become more and more important. And where you use the, in a religious community, church community, where you base your unity on Constitution, you're getting in trouble. It's a foundational document, ultimately Scriptures, but then the document is confessions. Catechism particularly, the two catechisms, more catechism, the hymn book. Rather than just talking about divine servants, it's the hymn book is very, very important in practical terms. Okay, foundational stories. Okay, I could speak more, but just anything,
let's see, how's time going?
9 o'clock, okay. Any remarks, questions?
Foundational stories are fictional, at least partly, in there, so they're subject to reinterpretation and reworking and so forth. And you get so how does that, even Exodus, we read it differently than the Jews do. So
yes.
How does this impact the way that we look at
families. Okay, now you're betraying your Enlightenment way of thinking, modern way of thinking, with the adjective fictional.
Well, I mean, in the sense.
I don't want to pick a fight, but what's important to see, what's the fictional element in it? It's, you build on real things, real events, but those real events and real documents assume an importance that they didn't originally have. And in fact, if things go well, they become less important as time passes on, which you'd expect, but they become more important. And what's interesting, in those foundational stories, that's why I use stories rather than fiction, you could say legends, real intellectual scholars call myths. Now, the technical term is myth, but for most people, hear the wrong thing with myths. What happens then is that it's not the full story in terms of biography, but there are certain features that are highlighted in the story. There's certain features that are highlighted in the foundational documents, which features become more and more important as time goes on.
The ones that fit the culture has embraced about themselves.
Yes, that they've embraced about themselves, but people don't do things for just theoretical reasons. It's always for practical purposes. What determines as time passes on that this is emphasized rather than that? Just take a foundational story. Why is it that certain features are emphasized at one age that weren't emphasized earlier?
Because of new problems.
Yeah. The new problems, new challenges. And always when you're faced with a new challenge, the healthy thing is not to innovate, but to repristinate, in a sense. Not in the usual sense, but to go back to the past and to find resources to deal with the new challenges from the foundations. You see, what happens quite often, if I can use an analogy, is of the building. Okay, you have a good set of foundations, and as time passes on, you put a veranda here and a wing here, and then you have an overlap here, and then sort of the building goes in this direction. And then there's a problem, the building looks like it's going to fall over because it has this great big wing here attached. What do you have to do when that wing is threatened? Either shore it up or else get rid of it. If it's not, doesn't serve any functional purpose. And instead of that, then you go back to the foundations. And build then up, if you like, rather than out. You build up rather than out. Now, as I read it, that something interesting is happening in your synod. Your president's a very good friend of mine, and I know him very well over many years. But one of his great virtues is that he knows your history. He knows your story. And he's not just telling the old story, but he's telling the old story to meet new problems. Now, that's a mark of a superb leader. Leaders tell stories, but they don't just tell the old story in the same way, but they find resources in the old stories to meet the new problems. If you like, from a scriptural point of view, you find resources in the scriptures that weren't used previously to deal with the new problems that you face. But I'm not talking from a scriptural point of view. Yeah. I don't know if that answers your question. If I can just give an example from our Australian church history, the foundational myth of the LCA, Lutheran Church of Australia, is that some group of religious refugees, like the Saxon migrants, came to Australia rather than to North America or to Siberia, which were the other options. Thank God they didn't go there. Are led under Carvel and Fritchie, they're the two founding fathers, and they established the Lutheran Church of Australia. Now, they were confessional Lutherans. But there were Lutheran congregations and missionaries and communities that were in Australia before these guys came. Now, why is it that their story, which is not was not the original story of all the Lutheran congregations, communities, has become the story of the LCA? Now, you can say that's a fiction, because historically speaking, it's not true. And historians will try and debunk the popular story, but why has it become the story and become, as time passes, it's more and more important? Well, it's because those communities and the theology and practice of those men and their communities became the catalyst drawing together into synods all those 1,001 little groups that were scattered all over the place, migrating not just from Germany, but from Scandinavia and France and Eastern Europe. Who were the people who were the center drawing it together? What was the theology that drew them together? It was the Lutheran confessions, the divine service, the conservative Lutheran theology that they embodied. And then, so the story is that we have Lutherans in Australia who, like Pilgrim Fathers, came to Australia for religious purposes to escape persecution. Now, if you look at the actual family histories, that's only a small group of people. So historically speaking, you can say it's a fiction, but that misses the point entirely. Because this, the purpose of the story is not to tell you what actually happened, but to understand where you are, and to understand yourself in the light of the past. That's a very important question. Have I answered it? It's something that modern historians particularly find a great difficulty to appreciate, at least up till the last 5 or 10 years. There's a new school of historiography which is much more sympathetic to this. And I want to talk a little bit more about the view on history that we have in the Old Testament.
Can I ask, I'm curious, you mentioned that there's a relationship between the English language and our view of history, and I'm curious if the same can be said maybe for the Hebrew language and how they view history.
Oh, yeah, it's so obvious once you get inside the Hebrew language. Hebrew doesn't have a tense system, the verb. So they live in a different world linguistically. And I don't know whether you realize, basically your whole world is shaped by language. The way you see everything is shaped by your language. Your language makes you. Now, in Hebrew you have two basic forms of the verb. You have the perfect and the imperfect. Now, that's putting it in Western Germanic terms. There's the incomplete tense and then there's the complete tense. So there's no future tense in Hebrew. So an action is either seen as being incomplete or complete. If you want to talk about things in the future, therefore you use the incomplete tense. Because the future is always the result of what's going on now. Now, what happens, this is, I've taught Hebrew for many years. What I found very difficult was, people would learn the paradigms and verb forms and so on, but they found great difficulty getting into the language because they were basically still locked in English. What I tried to do was to get them to actually enter the language, and what the language does is to place you, if you like, in that paradigm where the past is behind you and the future is in front of you. And looking from that point of view, there's two things. If you look backwards, then there is a completed action and there's an action that's still going on. Now that's the basic orientation. So yes, language does it. And if you ever have to work in Africa, or if you work in Asia with Chinese, they have another completely different language system, which sees the world and the events that are happening in different ways. No doubt, I don't know the way the 10 system in Kenya, but no doubt it's different to the English and Indo-Germanic way of looking at things.
Well, basically, you can talk of three tenses, but
yes.
In terms of events,
yes.
Events are more focused in the past, the future speed is more.
Yes, so it's basically oriented towards the past. What are the three tenses?
Yeah, past, present, and future.
Yes.
So you can talk of events.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. There's some of the Asian languages basically don't have tenses but have adverbial markers. So I go now, or I go then, or I am yet to go. I yet go. Do you get the basic thing? You have the basic verbal action. And you use, and it's not, but it's not only that. You don't have not only have time markers, but you have place markers and you have person markers. I by myself, or I with you, go or do something here, or I do something there. A different language system altogether. One of the problems that we have in the West is that we claim to think in universal terms. Now, this is the right way of thinking, which in fact is not universal terms, but it's just basically Western way of thinking. And we assume that the Western way of thinking is the only way of thinking, by the way. And then that causes great problems politically, and it's a great hindrance towards mission work. Because if you're going to do mission with people in other countries, what you have to do? Translate the gospel, God's word. Not to try and get them to become Americans and think like Americans and live like Americans, but to put the gospel in their own terms. And that is hard, believe you me. Any other questions before we have a break? Okay, let's have 5 minutes break or so. There's some drink.